those on pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And that is a great way to look at them, though I'll note, as I cheekily did with Dane, who organized the series, that seeing these as songs for pilgrims heading to Jerusalem is really just a scholarly best guess as to what's going on. It's certainly plausible, but by no means certain. So you can take it in other ways, but that is, I think, a good way. The way that they are packaged, it can indeed serve as a guide for a traveling community, those who are on a journey. There seems to be movement. In that, so far, we've already looked at a few of the Psalms. Psalm 120 was a cry of distress from the psalmist, living among those who seek violence. But then Psalm 121 opens with a similar sense of distress, but moves to acknowledge Yahweh as one who protects the psalmist in such intimate ways, protecting even the psalmist's comings and goings. Psalm 122, then, is full of love for Jerusalem, where Yahweh's temple was, and where Yahweh's promise to the people was rooted. And then Psalm 123 moves back again to lamenting hardships. And you can sense some up and down along this journey. Psalm 123 does lament hardships, except at this point the focus moves from the single person to the community, calling for God's mercy on them as a community. So the pattern from 120 onward seems to have been distress call, acknowledgement of God meeting one in distress, and then a rejoicing, and then back down to distress call. It's like climbing the hills near Jerusalem, in fact. There's a lot there. There's a lot of steep ups and downs. Psalm 120, and then again at Psalm 123, those might be best read as being at the bottom of a valley on that route. And high points, like Psalm 122, perhaps would best be read from a hilltop. Perhaps a hilltop affording a vision of Jerusalem on a hilltop in the distance. And so in this whole series, I encourage you to consider the movement of these Psalms of Ascent in your own reading of them and in your listening to the sermons. Think about what is the movement that's going on and how do these Psalms fit together? Because clearly they are packaged together, so there's some kind of connection between them. So you can read them in isolation and you can read them together as a group. And so we find ourselves today at Psalm 124, and thank you to Matt for reading it for us today. I want to read it again for us, and I want us to consider the poetic imagery of the psalm and note also the journey that it describes, because I think there's movement even within this one short psalm. I'm going to read a different translation here, although the NIV one is mostly fine. The Message one I had some problems with, but that's fine. if I remember, I'll bring up where I think that there's a particular thing I want us to notice that is missing in that one. But after I read it, I'm going to give you some time to shout out things that you maybe noticed or that stood out to you, just to kind of get some of us thinking. We don't have to come up with great conclusions. This is really just what's happening for you as you read it. For that, I recommend having your Pew Bible open to consult after I'm done reading. And as Matt said, it's on page 424 in the Pew Bible. While I read, if you're able, because this is a different one, just listen along. A song of ascents, connected to David. If it had not been Yahweh who was for us, let Israel say, if it had not been Yahweh who was for us, when people rose against us, then beasts would have devoured us when their anger burned against us. Then the waters would have flooded us. The torrent would have swept over us. Then the raging waters would have swept over us. Blessed is Yahweh, who did not give us as prey to their teeth. Like a bird, we have escaped the trapper's snare. The snare is broken, and we escaped. Our help is in the name of Yahweh, maker of heaven and earth. Okay, what do you notice? What stands out to you? Anything? Eli? So yeah, noticing how the people trust in the Lord, who maybe is so strange, but they're willing still to trust. Yeah, cool. Thanks, Eli. There's eating of people, devouring. There ends up not being eating of people. Yes. Okay. Thanks, Melody. Tom. Okay. So seeing their enemies as kind of embodiments of creation in some form or another. Okay. Yeah. Anything else? And the snare what, sorry? And the snare is broken. Yeah, so the waters are like chaos in this, kind of this personified chaos, and then you get this snare imagery and the simile there, and the snare is broken. Okay. Yeah. Right, to justify, we're the ones that God loves, and...
Yeah, had God not been with us, this would have happened, this would have happened, this would have happened. It's the therefore that sort of I'm worried about, like, mm-hmm. Therefore we can.
Right, okay, so almost justifying a violence done to others because Yahweh's on our side, or potentially, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually have a line later that likens it to a preacher, so thank you for that. Yeah, yeah. So this that line in the at the beginning there, of like, let Israel say, like enjoining people to respond, to live into this. Yeah, Christine. Okay, a Psalm of David. Yeah, that is a notoriously difficult thing to understand in Hebrew. It says, you know, there's this just little le. It means like concerning David, about David, by David, for David. Don't know. So I just translated it as connected to David, because that's probably the best way to leave it ambiguous. Yeah. Anything else stands out for anybody? Emily. A communal hope. Yeah. Most of the Psalms of Ascent so far have been pretty singular, and we move into more plural. There's been a little bit of plural, but this is where there's the most kind of sense of communal and pluralness. Yeah. Yeah, noticing that pattern. You've been paying attention. We had in that kind of hilltop thing I was talking about, the first one was a cry of distress. The second one was a cry of distress, but also acknowledging that, you know, our help comes from Yahweh. And so that happens here again, too. This would be, if we are looking at this kind of pattern of 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, in the second one of both, we have this acknowledgement of help coming from Yahweh. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. There's lots of other things to notice. We'll walk through some. And if you have questions along the way, feel free to interrupt, ask a question. The setting of Psalm 124 seems to be some reference to humanity or people setting themselves up against the people of Judah, where the psalmist comes from. It doesn't say who those people are who stand up against Judah, but Babylon could be a good candidate, but perhaps it's appropriately anonymous for a liturgical song, for a song that a community would use in a variety of settings. Whatever this scenario was, people opposed or fought against Judah, but Yahweh was with Judah. Then the psalmist explains their experience and does so with a series of harrowing images: beasts, flood, waters, and bird trappers. So, beasts. In the Hebrew Bible, there are many references to what wild beasts can do. Elisha, a prophet in 2 Kings, is mocked by some local kids, calling him Baldy, and he turns and sicks some bears on them, and they maul 42 of the children. It's a bit of a terrifying story. In Leviticus 26, another example, this is where God is outlining the covenant with Israel. And on one side, if they are disobedient to this covenant and abandon justice, then God says, I will let loose wild animals against you, and they shall bereave you of your children and destroy your livestock. They shall make you few in number, and your roads shall be deserted. Because roads are often where you get attacked by wild animals. Likewise, on the other side, God offers protections from such wild beasts if the Israelites are obedient and just in their community. At one point, another story, when the Assyrians destroyed one of Israel's kingdoms in the north, they resettled the land with non-Israelites. And then when these non-Israelites first settled there, they did not worship Yahweh. Therefore, Yahweh sent lions among them, which killed some of them. These wild beasts were considered a real threat. And they even come up in some significant symbolism later. Can anyone think of where wild beasts serve as an image of terrifying enemies of God's people? In the Hebrew Bible, but also when you're backpacking, sure. Yes, Eli? Political figures? Okay, yeah, Paul? Daniel, that's the one I was going for. I mean, maybe Christine, do you have another? Yeah, in Revelation as well, in the New Testament, yeah, which is drawing on Daniel 7. So there you get these monstrous beasts that have kind of horns coming out of here and all kinds of crazy imagery associated with them. And they come up out of the sea in Daniel 7 and oppress God's people until God delivers them. Beasts are often used as images of oppressive forces. And the fact that in Daniel 7 that they come from the sea is interesting. You may have heard me say before that the sea was often considered by the Israelites to be the den of monsters. Most prominent in the Hebrew Bible is the sea personified as monsters like Leviathan, or sometimes called Rahab. These monsters threaten the existence of Israel, and this is where images of God dividing the waters, the sea waters, of creation, or splitting the waters in Exodus come from. It's from the same image of defeating the sea that opposes them. Yahweh as victorious over the sea. Even the crossing of the Jordan River plays on this theme, since we know that Israelites and their neighbors frequently considered the sea and rivers to be personifications of the same forces. Now, in Psalm 124, to come back to that, we have blurred language of rising flood as well as raging torrents. Now, the land of Palestine isn't known for its major rivers. Sorry, yes, Paul. Sure. That's true. Yeah, when during his temptation scene, then the wild beasts come and they're with Jesus. You also get in Isaiah, is it in 11, where you know there none of the wild beasts are attacking each other. You get like the lion and the lamb and that kind of stuff. So. And the counterpoint as well, it still is assuming that these are wild and devouring beasts, but look at what God can do. Yeah. Okay, so the land of Palestine isn't known for its major rivers, other than maybe the Jordan River, but even that isn't raging or even that large. So where does this torrent imagery come from? In the hilly parts of the land of Palestine, you have deep gorge-like valleys, and that's kind of where I was getting at with the hilly imagery. And in some places, the bottom of those valleys is the only place where you can reliably get water. And so if you're a shepherd or if you're a traveler, you need to go down there to get water. The trouble is, if you go down there to get water, and 10 kilometers away, right at kind of the top of the hills, rain falls, even just a little bit. The land is so chalky that it all rushes down into the bottom of the valley and you are swept away. Flash flood. And even to this day, flash floods occasionally take lives there. It is a real threat. Wild beasts and raging torrents, symbols though they may be, are real threats. But as the psalmist reflects on these things, the attention turns to the actions of Yahweh. Yahweh emphatically did not give the people to the teeth of the beasts. Instead, although they were caught by an enemy, a surprise escape occurs. The bird escapes the trap and flies free. But this is not the bird's doing. It was Yahweh who delivered them. Yahweh who defeated the bird catcher. Yahweh, the maker of heaven and earth. And you've probably heard me before that I prefer to say Yahweh rather than Lord in a lot of these cases, because whenever you see the in the text, all caps, L-O-R-D, it is a stand-in, not for the actual word Lord or Master, but for the divine name Yahweh. Putting it in all caps, L-O-R-D, comes from a long and good tradition of revering the divine name of Israel's God by not pronouncing it, right? They were wanting to respect it and not pronounce it. However, there are lots of other ways to respect it, and this has, I think, obscured things for modern readers, where they tend to read a modern version of monotheism back into the ancient text, thinking that Lord is just another way of saying God, and that there's really only one God anyway. But Psalm 24 is not merely saying that God is on their side, as the message did, but that the psalmist is saying that their God is Yahweh and not any other God. Not the seemingly powerful god Marduk of Babylon, not Ashur of the Assyrians, not Baal, not Asherah, not any other god. It is staking a claim for Yahweh. And what better way to do it than to claim that Yahweh, their defender, is also maker of heaven and earth? A claim that is that others made for their gods, to be sure. And this comes from a conquered people. This is not a powerful people, and this is partly to Charlie's point earlier. This is not a powerful people who are wielding the weapon and being able to go out and conquer and saying, you know, our God leads us into this. This is, we are a conquered people, and yet we know that God delivers us. Now, while you and I might think, of course, God made heaven and earth, that's what it means to be a God, or to be God, but that's absolutely not taken for granted in ancient Israel and Judah. This statement is a polemic. It's an argument for Yahweh against any other gods, particularly those gods of the biggest and most powerful oppressive nations of the day. And so the psalmist is reflecting. Our help is in the name of Yahweh. No one else. Nothing else. And that brings me back to the beginning. If it hadn't been Yahweh who was for us, let Israel say, if it hadn't been Yahweh who was for us, what might have happened had Yahweh not been for them? The psalmist wants them to think on that. So, to be honest, when I began to prepare for this sermon, I thought, WWJD, what would Jake do? Jake gets a lot more excited about Psalms than I do. I don't have anything against the Psalms. I just tend to prefer prose or narrative. But Jake loves the Psalms. So what would Jake do? Well, I don't know much about the Seahawks, so that won't work. And I don't play Zelda, although maybe I did once upon a time. Jake did tell some great stories about journeys or road trips in his latest sermon. But I racked my brain trying to think of a good story of a journey, one that I would know well enough to tell. So Frodo was with his friends, thank you, was with his friends Merry and Pippin and his faithful Samwise. They'd fled from menacing horsemen robed all in black as they were chased from one end of the Shire to the other. They made it across the Brandywine River by ferry just before these riders caught up with them. But Frodo knew that this only bought them a few hours' reprieve and that they must leave the Shire before they're caught, and they must leave by an altogether unexpected route through the old forest. Not in the movies, by the way. Read the books. And if you knew half the stories I've heard about the old forest, you too would be frightened. The old forest is ominous, full of mystery, and many of the trees bear an ill will to those that go about on 2 feet. Frodo and his friends found this out firsthand as they made their way across the forest, with branches nearly falling on them and with the paths always inexplicably changing and driving them down toward the river Withywindle, not where they wanted to go. Though it was completely out of their way, they ended up there along the Withywindle banks in the heat of the afternoon. They found themselves abnormally drowsy. Mary and Pippin decided to rest in the shade of a nearby willow. Frodo rested on a root of the willow overhanging the water. Sam padded off slowly to find their ponies who had wandered off. But just as he was mumbling to himself about how unnatural this drowsiness was, he heard a small but firm click, as well as a splash, and rushed back to find Frodo in the water. When he got Frodo out of the water, Frodo accused the willow of pushing him under. Sam had a hard time believing this, but when they turned around to check on the others, they saw that Pippin had vanished, and that Merry's whole upper body was folded into a crack of the willow with only his legs sticking out. The click that Sam had heard was the sound of the tree closing in over Pippin. What were they to do? They beat upon the trunk. They tried to pull Merry free. They kicked the tree, but its rustled leaves sounded like distant laughter. They gathered some brush and set a fire on the far side of the trunk. At this, though, there was no more laughter. Instead, they heard Mary's voice now. "Put it out! Put it out! He'll squeeze me in two if you don't. He says so." The tree began to shake violently, and ripples of anger spread out over the whole forest. Sam stamped out the fire, but Frodo, without any clear idea of why he did so or what he hoped for, ran along the path, crying, "Help! Help! Help!" It seemed to him that he could hardly hear the sound of his own shrill voice. It was blown away from him by the willow wind and drowned in a clamor of leaves as soon as the words left his mouth. He felt desperate, lost, and witless, sounding a bit like a couple of the Psalms of Ascent. Suddenly, Frodo stopped. There was an answer, or so he thought. He turned round and listened, and soon there could be no doubt. Someone was singing a song. A deep, glad voice was singing carelessly and happily, but it was singing nonsense. Frodo and Sam stood as if enchanted. The wind puffed out. The leaves hung silently again on stiff branches. There was another burst of song, and then suddenly, hopping and dancing along the path, there appeared above the reeds an old battered hat with a tall crown and a long blue feather stuck in the band. With another hop and a bound, there came into view a man, or so it seemed, with great yellow boots on his thick legs and charging through grass and rushes like a cow going down to drink. He had a blue coat and a long brown beard. His eyes were blue and bright, and his face was red as a ripe apple, but creased into 100 wrinkles of laughter. "Help!" cried Frodo and Sam, running towards him with their hands stretched out. "Whoa, whoa, steady there," cried the old man, holding up one hand, and they stopped short, as if they had been struck stiff. "Now, my little fellows, where be you a-going to, puffing like a bellows? What's the matter here, then? Do you know who I am? I'm Tom Bombadil. Tell me, what's your trouble? Tom's in a hurry now. Don't you crush my lilies." "My friends are caught in the willow tree," cried Frodo breathlessly. "Master Merry's being squeezed in a crack," said Sam. "What? Old Man Willow? Not worse than that, eh? That can soon be mended. I know the tune for him, old gray willow man." Tom ran to the tree and put his mouth to the crack and began singing into it in a low voice. Merry's legs began to kick. Tom sprang away and, breaking off a hanging branch, smote the side of the willow with it. "You let them out again, old man willow," he said. "What be you a-thinking of? You should not be waking. Eat earth, dig deep, drink water, go to sleep. Bombadil is talking." He then seized Merry's feet and drew him out of the suddenly widening crack. There was a tearing creak and the other crack split open, and out of it Pippin sprang as if he had been kicked. Then with a loud snap, both cracks closed fast again. A shudder ran from the tree from root to tip, and complete silence fell. "Thank you," said the hobbits one after the other. Tom Bombadil burst out laughing. "Well, my little fellows," said he, stooping so that he peered into their faces, "you shall come home with me. The table is all laden with yellow cream, honeycomb, and white bread and butter. Goldberry is waiting." Now later, once they had time to catch their breath and take stock, the hobbits uncomfortably considered what would have happened had it not been for Tom Bombadil's appearance just then. There was no conceivable way to retrieve Pippin, and Merry was soon to be swallowed up by Old Man Willow. Would Frodo and Sam ever have made it out of the forest alive, with all the trees under the sway of the Willow Man? Likely that would have been the end of their story. But it wasn't. Tom Bombadil rescued them from the mortal danger in which they found themselves. If it hadn't been for Tom. So much akin to the tone of Psalm 124. If it hadn't been for Yahweh. Torn apart by beasts, engulfed by the flood, caught in a snare. But Yahweh and Tom is in the business of rescue. And so as I reflect once again on the psalm, I'm drawn back to the initial line. If it had not been Yahweh who was for us, let Israel say, if it had not been Yahweh who was for us. As we've said, they wouldn't like to think what would have happened had it not been Yahweh who was for them. But what stands out to me is that interruption of the line, let Israel say. Like Jeanette said, this is like an attempt to wake the worshiping community up. Let the people remember. Let the people reflect on what might have happened had Yahweh not delivered them. Let them reflect on Yahweh who delivers people from disaster. This is not just one psalmist's reflection. It is like a preacher or worship leader telling the people to get up, get on your feet, and remember what Yahweh has done for us. And not just me in the singular, not just you in the singular, but for us, for all of us, for all people who are in need. So let Grandview say, if it had not been Yahweh who was for us, for those who need rescue. So many of us, so many times, have referred to the past several years as such a painful time for so many reasons, and I'm not going to belabor that point. It's been done. But what I am going to mention is that I'm excited to see that we're doing decently well now. We're heading in a good direction. Not without problems, not without faults, of course, but we're heading in a good direction. And there are so many people to thank for all that they've put into Grandview these past years. Monica gave out pottery thank yous not long ago for that very reason. But let's not forget that God is for us. I'm inclined to think that God has rescued us from our beasts, floods, and bird catchers. No, we are not unscathed. The psalmist doesn't say that either. But God has rescued us. And I am deeply grateful, and grateful that that can be done together. And we remember that God is for us and for those who are hurting, those who are marginalized and excluded, those who are suffering, those who cannot find safety from violence. In Gaza and the West Bank and Sudan and everywhere, people are dehumanized and victimized, even in our own church. And sometimes we may be the beasts or the floods. And so we call out in the voice of the psalmist for God to step in and rescue. And Psalm 124 reminds us that God does care and God does rescue. And as the psalmist, we must keep remembering that. If it had not been Yahweh who was for those in need of rescue. But I want us to keep remembering that communally. We need to remember together that God rescues, that God stands with all those in need, and we need to remind each other of that. We need to sing about it, pray about it, live it. So let Grandview say, indeed, God is with us. God is with us, my friends, and in that I take great comfort.